KSDP 8:30 a.m. Sandpoint K201DA King Matsu Co KFPS Falls Pass
course of study for Matsu Borough School District juniors and seniors. Students take both high school and college courses while completing their high school graduation requirements. Students are provided free college tuition, textbooks, and a computer. For more information, come to the Glen Massey Theater, 6:30 p.m. on January 28th. Matsu Middle College School is the place to be. This message sponsored by Matsu Middle College School.
Good morning. Once the fires burn out, many people in Los Angeles will want to rebuild. How much will insurance companies help? We'll ask California Senator Alex Padilla in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. If a wildfire was on your doorstep and you had to leave home, what would you take with you? I'm Steve Inske.
And Amy Martinez. We'll hear from people in Los Angeles who just had to make that quick and difficult decision. Also, part two of Steve Inskeep's interview with Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and two new operas that premiered at the Kennedy Center are changing stereotypes and bringing new voices to the stage. It's Wednesday, January 14th, a TV version of The Flash. Actor Grant Gustin is 35 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President-elect Trump's nominee to be Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, is appearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee for his confirmation hearing. Hegseth began his opening statement last hour, but was soon interrupted by the first of at least three protesters. The protesters have been escorted out of the confirmation hearing. NPR's Tom Bowman reports Hegseth says he plans to restore the warrior ethos to the Pentagon.
Hegseth is a National Guard combat veteran and a former Fox News host. In his opening statement, he takes on his lack of experience for the job, saying his biography is not like other defense secretaries who have come from the top ranks of politics, industry, and the military. Hegseth says it's time to place someone with, quote, dust on his boots at the helm of the Defense Department. Calling himself a change agent, Hegseth has complained about what he calls a woke military that is based on quotas and not merit, and he has opposed women in ground combat jobs, something that's been allowed for 9 years. Hegseth says he will make sure warriors are fully qualified on their weapons and insists that generals and admirals are chosen on merit. Tom Bowman, NPR News.
Forecasters have issued their most serious warnings for wind in the Los Angeles area today. This could make uncontained wildfires worse. The Palisades fire burning west of L.A. is now 17% contained. The Eaton fire in the Pasadena-Altadena area is more than a third contained. President Biden is urging Congress to quickly approve federal disaster aid, but House Speaker Mike Johnson claims, without offering evidence, California officials mishandled the situation. He wants to put limits on the assistance.
I think there should probably be conditions on that aid. That's my personal view. We'll see what the consensus is. I haven't had a chance to socialize that with any of the members over the weekend because we've all been very busy, but it'll be part of the discussion.
Democratic lawmakers say any disaster response for any part of the country should not be linked with political conditions. The Justice Department has released its report on Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. As NPR's Kristen Wright reports, it does not include a second part of Special Counsel Jack Smith's investigation.
The separate, unreleased volume of Smith's report focuses on Trump's handling of classified documents after leaving the White House. Prosecutors charged the former president with keeping the documents at his Mar-a-Lago resort and refusing to return them to the government. Florida District Judge Aileen Cannon ordered the Justice Department to hold off on releasing that part of Smith's report for now. Trump's two former co-defendants in the classified documents case are asking the court to block its release because of their ongoing litigation. After Trump was reelected in November, the Justice Department dropped the cases against him, citing longstanding department policy prohibiting federal prosecutions of sitting presidents. Kristen Wright, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up about 55 points. It's NPR.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. State lawmakers have released more than 80 proposals for new laws and constitutional amendments ahead of the legislative session that starts next Tuesday. The first batch of pre-filed bills was released last week. They cover a wide range of topics, from elections to education, healthcare, energy, and even artificial intelligence. Some of the bills aim to tackle key priorities lawmakers campaigned on this past fall. Senate Majority Leader Kathy Geisel, an Anchorage Republican, has pre-filed a bill that would return public sector workers to a pension system. A similar bill passed the Senate last year, but failed to advance in the Republican-led House amid questions about its cost. Geisel says a return to a pension system would both help the state recruit and retain employees while limiting the state's risk.
This bill is not your grandfather's pension. This bill is a modern pension, which spreads the risk among retirees, active employees, and the employer.
Geisel says she sees a, quote, positive future for the bill, with a pension-friendly coalition of moderate Republicans, Democrats, and independents set to take control of the House. Representative-elect Chuck Kopp, an Anchorage Republican slated to be the majority leader in the lower chamber, says he anticipates the House Finance Committee will take a closer look at a similar shared risk pension proposal and come up with its own tweaks based on hearings and public input.
It will be a priority bill for the House and treated as such by being a committee bill.
Meanwhile, Sutton Republican Representative George Rauscher has pre-filed a bill on another 2024 campaign issue, repealing ranked choice voting and open primaries. Alaskans rejected a similar ballot question in November by the narrowest of margins, just over 700 votes. Pre-filing a bill can highlight an issue of importance to a lawmaker or their constituents, but there's no guarantee that it will pass into law. Of the 665 bills introduced during the last legislature, just 13% made it through both chambers and passed the governor's veto pen. The U.S. Department of Agriculture will buy up to $50 million worth of Alaska pollock, according to a press release last week from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. The estimated 15 million pounds of pollock will go towards supplying food banks and other food aid programs around the country. The USDA spent about $200 million purchasing seafood like salmon and pollock last year, according to AFSCME officials. Alaska pollock is the country's largest fishery by volume, but it was among several species that saw prices plummet in 2023. The USDA buy also comes after another bad year for pollock fishermen in the Gulf of Alaska. The fishery's bee season came to a close months early because of an unprecedented amount of Chinook caught as bycatch or incidental harvest. The A season for the pollock fisheries in both the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska start this month. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. With me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Coming up, we'll speak with U.S. Senator Alex Padilla of California about the fires that are still scorching through Los Angeles. That's a city where he was born and raised.
First, we have news of Special Counsel Jack Smith, who will not record a criminal conviction against President-elect Trump, but will leave his conclusions for the history books.
The Justice Department lawyer investigated Trump for his bid to overturn his defeat in the 2020 election. Smith dropped two criminal cases after Trump's win in 2024, following a long-standing policy against prosecuting a sitting president. But his report on one of those cases is now public, and it asserts that the evidence would have convicted him. Smith also says it is, quote, laughable that he acted from political motives.
NPR's Carrie Johnson joins us now after a very late night and early morning on this story. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What does it matter that Jack Smith's report would be public now, given that he's not going to prosecute?
This was really a last chance for prosecutors to explain their decisions and defend themselves. It also could accomplish some measure of accountability for people who were hurt on January 6, 2021. Some of those police officers, there are civil lawsuits that are ongoing that continue against Donald Trump and others. And it's also really a record for history at a time when Trump and many other Republican lawmakers are clinging to fake claims about election fraud in 2020 and calling those people who stormed the Capitol patriots.
Because the final report was being argued over, the release of the report was being argued over in court, I had my doubts as to whether we would see it before January 20th, Inauguration Day. How did that work out?
Yeah, every step of this investigation has been a battle. And even late last night, Trump tried one last time to get a judge to block this report, but he did not succeed. And remember, the Supreme Court handed him a significant victory last year, ruling he had some immunity from prosecution. The justices there took so long to decide, the clock ran out on this indictment here in Washington, D.C. And really, over the past week, Trump's former aides at the Mar-a-Lago resort had asked Florida Judge Eileen Cannon to block this report, even though that case was no longer in front of her. It was really an open question whether we'd see it up till last night.
In the end, she did not block it. And so last night you get these 150 pages. What stands out for you?
Jack Smith wrote there was enough evidence to convict Trump at trial of these four felony charges related to efforts to overthrow the 2020 election. Smith says the ultimate decision in this case to charge Trump was up to him, and he stands by that. He says even though they couldn't get to trial because of the DOJ view that a sitting president cannot face criminal trial, that this effort mattered, that the rule of law matters, that the example his prosecutor set to fight for justice despite personal costs and attacks and threats, that all matters. Jack Smith wrote, as a prosecutor, you cannot control the outcome, but you can do your job in the right way for the right reasons. And he says they did.
And it is interesting, given that Trump and his supporters have characterized Smith very negatively, that Smith is saying, no, actually, we set an example. We were doing the right thing here. That is his case. Is that the last word from him?
You know, special counsels are typically invited to testify in Congress once their work is done. Democrats have asked the Justice Department to save all of Smith's files. Republicans want to investigate him. And President-elect Trump has vowed retribution. Jack Smith actually resigned before he could be fired by Trump. And other prosecutors who worked on the Smith investigations have been making plans to leave the Justice Department too. Trump's nominees to lead the DOJ and the FBI in the next administration have promised to investigate those investigators. So it could be a difficult road ahead financially and otherwise for a lot of these people who worked in the government.
And there might be questions about those investigations, promised investigations, and confirmation hearings to come. Carrie, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
NPR's Carrie Johnson.
Crews are working around the clock to contain the flames scorching through the Los Angeles area, but recovery for the affected communities will take a long time. Democratic United States Senator Alex Padilla of California has visited the hardest hit areas. He joins us now. Senator, you were born and raised in Los Angeles, specifically Pacoima, right near the Hearst Fire. How personal is this for you? What have you seen?
You know, it's as up close and personal as it can get. Thankfully, friends and family, including my own home, been right on the edge of those evacuation zones. We're okay, but my heart goes out to the thousands and thousands of families that have either lost their homes or at least lost their sense of security, having to evacuate, wondering when they're going to be able to go home, what's next, and how we're going to begin to rebuild.
President Biden has vowed that the federal government will do any and everything to help California, but in a week, he is no longer president. So how much support do you expect or hope to get from Donald Trump?
Yeah, first and foremost, a big thank you to President Biden, who happened to be in Los Angeles as these windstorms and fires flared up last week. So as I've said, he wasn't in the Situation Room. He was literally in the situation and acted swiftly. I'm hopeful that President Trump will do the right thing, frankly, despite the political rhetoric that we've heard from him in recent days. I'm hopeful because the California delegation request for aid, and thank you to President Biden, was bipartisan. The California House Republicans joined us in those efforts, and I imagine their support's going to continue.
Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville and House Speaker Mike Johnson have suggested or even just flat out said that disaster aid to California should be conditional, determined around changing policies on wildfire prevention. If they were sitting in front of you, what would you say to that?
I'd say, come on, we've never done that before. California's always been there for other regions of the country in their time of crisis, and now it's time for the country to be there for California. No strings attached.
Is there any mechanism you're aware of where aid could be restricted or limited based on certain conditions?
Look, it's never been done before, but we're not living in typical political times. So people of California, people of Los Angeles know that I, Senator Schiff, the entire delegation are united in fighting for what's right, fighting for all the relief that families deserve. We'll navigate through these politics.
Now, in order for communities to rebuild, insurance companies, help from insurance companies is going to be critical. But a lot of companies have been leaving California. A lot of families did not have coverage, especially in Pacific Palisades going into these fires. So what can be done to get insurance companies to help out?
Yeah, that's a significant question, not just for the state of California. You can look at Florida and some of the recent hurricanes that are increasing in magnitude and devastation. They're having insurance troubles there. Louisiana is no stranger to natural disasters. It warrants a federal look at what we can do to buttress the insurance market and help make families as whole as possible wherever insurance falls short.
Considering how likely it is for wildfires to once again hit parts of California, you mentioned other parts of the country that deal with natural disasters, how wise is it to rebuild in areas that are always going to be in a constant position of threat, of fire threat, of disaster threat?
Yeah, it's an ongoing balancing act because we do have a growing population. We do have a growing economy. We do need, you know, additional housing. So in some places where it absolutely does not make sense to rebuild, and I'm not just talking about, you know, the recent fires in Palisades or Pasadena, Altadena. I'm talking more globally here. That's a legitimate question, but where we can rebuild and should rebuild, let's at least rebuild smarter, more sustainably. We've come a long way with building materials, types of building design that can be much more resilient. You know, wood shingle roofs, that should be a thing of the past. Wood paneling in vulnerable areas does not make sense. So in many areas, we will rebuild, but let's build back smarter.
So, Senator, while I have you here, I know that you were just recently in Los Angeles, but you're back here in D.C. For the Senate confirmation hearings. A lot of public job interviews this week. How do you expect them all to go?
You know, Democrats are taking these confirmation hearings and the process seriously. Some of these nominees raise a lot of questions and concerns, and we're not going to be shy about bringing them to the fore. I mean, that's what this process is for. President Trump won the election. He deserves to nominate his cabinet, but the Senate has an important responsibility here to vet and to either approve or not. Buckle your seatbelts. Public service is serious business. This isn't just a cast of characters that should come forward.
That's United States Senator Alex Padilla of California. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a new year and a new look for the American tennis phenom Coco Gauff. After a series of losses last year, Gauff switched up her technique, and now at the Australian Open, she's putting it to the test. Here's NPR's Becky Sullivan.
Last year should have been a great one for Gauff, who's perhaps the most promising American tennis player since the Williams sisters. She was fresh off her first Grand Slam title, ranks number 3 in the world. By summer's end, she admitted it hadn't gone the way she wanted.
Yeah, I expect better, but at the end of the day, it happened, and I know I can turn it around.
What happened is that after a promising start to the year, Gauff fell apart. A fourth-round exit at Wimbledon, then an upset at the Paris Summer Olympics, and throughout a common theme, too many unforced errors, especially double faults on her serve.
Fans groaning. Another missed first serve.
Her problems came to a head in September in the fourth round of the U.S. Open, the very tournament she'd won the year before. But this day was a bad one. 60 unforced errors, 19 double faults, all of them valuable points handed to her opponent. After the last one, Gauff bounced her racket off the court in frustration.
That's 19.
For years, Gauff has used an unusual forehand grip, and she had long struggled with her second serve, weaknesses that were being exposed. Afterward, a reporter asked if she'd consider hiring a special coach to address her technique.
Yeah, I definitely want to look at other things because I don't want to lose matches like this anymore.
Barely 2 weeks later, Gauff parted ways with her old coach and soon after announced she'd hired a new one. Matt Daly, who played tennis at Notre Dame, then helped create a training device for players to perfect a technique known as the continental grip. In tennis, changing your mechanics can be a months-long project. She's seen improvements already. She won the WTA finals at the end of last year. And her new coach has helped with something even more fundamental, she says, her confidence.
You know, when you step on court with confidence, and it makes a big difference in your game. So just, you know, keeping things real, like knowing that there's going to be good days and bad days and, you know, never making me feel judged because of that.
Now, the first Grand Slam of 2025 has arrived. In Melbourne at the Australian Open, Gauff swept through a tough opening round matchup on Monday. Gauff had 9 double faults, not ideal. But 9's a lot better than 19 as she moves on to the second round. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is Ava White, and you're listening to Alaska Public Media. Several borough-owned lots in Petersburg will get utilities in the next year or so. Lincoln and Haida Regional Housing Authority will do the work, and in return, the nonprofit will get 7 of the lots. The borough will keep the other 4. Assembly members voted unanimously in favor of the move last week. Assembly member Jay Stanton Greger said he supports the $3 million project.
This is going to be coming with roads, electric, water, sewer, and storm drainage utilities, all from Tlingit Haida. It is critical infrastructure to open up 11 new lots for the community of Petersburg, which means, in theory, so it'll open it up for 11 new families to have houses, home ownership at that. I think this is a no-brainer, and I hope it passes.
The project is a partnership between the Petersburg Borough, Tlingit and Haida, and the local tribe, Petersburg Indian Association, or PIA. Mayor Mark Jensen said he appreciates the collaboration. Tlingit and Haida will now hire engineers and put the plans together. The improvements to the 11 lots are estimated to cost nearly $3 million, but the borough manager said he expects that number to move around quite a bit once engineering looks at the project. He said the project should be underway by this summer. Have a great rest of your Tuesday morning. You are listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
Alaska's communities and people are unique, lively, and fascinating, and they have stories to match.
I started working here almost 20 years ago, and I was told by many people KYUK is haunted.
And I was thinking about how badly I would have wanted somebody to explain grief to me.
That's on Alaska News Nightly, weeknights at 6 p.m. on FM 91.1, wherever you listen to podcasts or check out alaskapublic.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From EBSCO, committed to making it easy for people to discover and access library resources anytime from anywhere with bibliograph and linked data technology. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Learn more at templeton.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. When you think about opera, what comes to mind? Be honest. Even after all these years, isn't the first thought probably wealthy white audience, mostly white cast, delivering works from centuries ago? But what about an opera about an office worker in Detroit dreaming of a better life? Or an opera about two black women competing to become mayor of Houston?
This city moves fast, Boudreaux. Try to keep up.
These are both part of a multi-year project at the Kennedy Center to bring new voices to the stage. Librettist Deborah Deep Mouton and composer Levi Taylor are each behind one of the works that premiered last week. They're both here now in our studios in Washington, D.C. to tell us more about their projects. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
So you've been working on these operas for a year. You're both experienced artists. Deborah, you as a literary artist and performer. Levi, you as a composer. But opera isn't your primary focus for either of you. So I was curious about what drew you to this project. Deborah, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I think, one, you know, an invitation from the Kennedy Center is never going to be turned down. Let's be real, right? But more than that, there's something really beautiful about opera and its blending of looking at musical genre as well as narrative storytelling that I think I've always found really appealing.
Levi, what about you? What was the process like with your librettist, Brittany Ward? Did the music come first or the story?
So the story came first, for sure. I really wanted that because I wanted to hear from Brittany, like, how she wanted the characters to feel, how she wanted the story to evolve.
Beautiful Detroit African, I see you. Do you see me?
Your work is The Seer. It's about the office worker in Detroit that I mentioned in my introduction. So tell me about that.
So the process was interesting with Brittany and I think that she and I both evolved once we started getting, fleshing out the idea of who Amma was and what the journey was, and the Amma is a reflection of Brittany's own journey. So it was very powerful, I think, creating this story that's telling a lot of what she's dealing with as a Black woman, you know, dealing with white supremacy. And so I think the process was personal and artistic at the same time.
So how did the music come about? It's so interesting.
It was
because so many operas are based on, you know, folk tales or legends. It's interesting to kind of put to score something that could be happening to somebody like today.
That was, to me, the most impactful and beautiful part of the moment is as I was reading her words and saying her words and singing her words as I'm trying to write this music. And then actually at one point I was like, hey, Brittany, I need you to record yourself saying these words so I can hear how you're talking about your story and hear the pauses and hear where the ups are and the downs are. And that helped a ton.
Waiting for no validation. We've been building the tables by ourselves and sitting down.
Deborah, what about you? Your piece is about two Black women candidates competing for mayor in Houston 4 decades from now. How did that all come about?
Yeah, I think it was our way of really mitigating polarity and, you know, and saying like we are more together and more alike than we are different. And we had a first draft. We were talking about how the orchestration was going to go. And then Kamala Harris becomes our, you know, the representative for the Democratic Party. And we kind of just looked at each other and we're like, what did we write? You know, it was that moment where it was like, it's going to look like we wrote this in reaction. But in the reality, we wrote this months before, thinking about what it means for a Black woman to live in that kind of power seat and what changes in policy she'd make.
And you also perform yourself in the opera with spoken word, which is not a thing that always happens. That's interesting.
It's not. But maybe it's a thing that should happen more often, right?
It's a landslide, y'all. Our newest leader is Imani Jade Boudreau.
What is it about the medium of opera that makes it a format in which you wanted to tell these stories?
I would say what sticks with you more than an earworm in your ear, right? Like then that melody you can't shake and get rid of. And I think that, you know, if we're looking at having a story that we want people to never be able to walk away from without thinking back on again, why not give it into a space where music serves it, right? And I think there is such a tradition of Black people in classical music that's under-celebrated. And for us to be able to come in, not even as a new guard, but as a continuation of the work that so many Black people have done, it's us being able to join in that conversation and not start it.
Levi, what about you?
One of my most favorite things about being a media composer, film, TV, some of my greatest heroes are doing this, right? So you got Terrence Blanchard's Champion, right? When I saw that, I was like, wait, there's somebody who looks like me who's writing stories about people of diversity that are just as relevant and compelling. In opera, we can create these motifs, these musical elements, these, you know, moments that just brings everything together and heightens it all.
A vote for Boudreau is a vote for vision.
The heart of this commissioning initiative, it's called the Cartography Project. It's not just about bringing new voices and new stories to the stage, but it's also about counteracting this notion that the Black experience is just one that's sort of rooted in tragedy, but that it has other lives and voices. And I was curious about how that resonated with you.
Yeah, I think for me, the word that came was complexity. Mm-hmm. The most well-known operatic work around Black people is Porgy and Bess, and it's not written by a Black person, you know? So it's like, what does it mean to be able to hold the pen in your own narration? I think there's something just really beautiful about being able to tap into that.
Are you also hoping that other people will show up because who might not have thought that opera was for them?
Absolutely. I 100%, because that's to me what stories are about, right? We share our stories and the emotion that we have, you know, through these stories and recognizing one another through our stories. That's why we make art, right? That's part of why we make art.
That's librettist Deborah Deep-Mouton and composer Levi Taylor. The operas premiered on January 10th at the Kennedy Center, and they will also be performed in New Orleans, Houston, Detroit, and Seattle. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dear citizens of Houston, it is my esteemed pleasure to be
The This is NPR News.
At All Things Considered, what unites all our conversations is curiosity.
Is he a good hugger?
Whether we're speaking to an aid worker.
What would you want them to know or understand about what you all are dealing with?
A scientist.
But what's in it for the dolphins?
Or a foreign leader.
If I may, I will ask the questions.
Killed by these rioting
police. I will ask the questions.
Questions and answers. Every day on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 3 on FM 91.1 or alaskapublic.org.
Alaska Public Media would like to remind you that now through March 31st, you can go online to file for your PFD at pfd.alaska.gov. When you do, you will have the option through Pick, Click, Give to donate a portion of your PFD to a nonprofit that matters to you. We hope you will choose Alaska Public Media. Your donation makes your favorite programming possible now and in the future. Go to pfd.alaska.gov to file today.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. This hour, the nominee for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is the first of President-elect Trump's candidates to sit for a Senate confirmation hearing. The chair of the Armed Services Committee, Senator Roger Wicker.
This nomination is unconventional. The nominee is unconventional. Just like that New York developer who rode down the escalator in 2015 to announce his candidacy for president.
Ranking Member Senator Jack Reed.
We must acknowledge the concerning public reports against you. A variety of sources, including your own writings, implicate you with disregarding the laws of war, financial mismanagement, racist and sexist remarks about men and women in uniform, alcohol abuse, sexual assault, sexual harassment, and other troubling issues.
The nominee says he's not a perfect person, but alleges he's the target of a media-driven smear campaign to destroy him.
And why do they want to destroy me? Because I'm a change agent and a threat to them, because Donald Trump was willing to choose me, to empower me, to bring the Defense Department back to what it really should be, which is warfighting.
Strong winds are bearing down on the Los Angeles area this hour, threatening to erase gains crews have made against destructive wildfires. More than 12,000 structures are destroyed. At least 24 lives have been lost. From Washington, this is NPR News. Russian authorities report large-scale Ukrainian drone and missile attacks on several regions of Russia. The apparent strikes were the latest to target Russian gas and industrial sites, as NPR's Charles Maines reports from Moscow.
In the Republic of Tatarstan, a drone hit a fuel storage tank, with video posted online showing smoke billowing towards the sky outside the capital, Kazan. Similar scenes unfolded in the Saratov region to the southwest, where drones hit industrial and fuel sites near a military airbase outside the city of Engels. That following an attack on a nearby oil depot last week. Meanwhile, in the border region of Bryansk, residents reported a series of explosions from what Russian media reported were Ukrainian-fired but American-made ATACMS rockets. Recent weeks have seen an uptick in attacks by both Russia and Ukraine, as each seeks to project strength in anticipation of potential new peace talks under the incoming Trump administration. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Country music star Carrie Underwood is expected to perform America the Beautiful at President-elect Trump's inauguration Monday. Other performers include opera singer Christopher Macchio and Village People, known for the 1970s hits YMCA and Macho Man, often heard at Trump's campaign rallies. U.S. stocks are mixed this hour. The Dow is up 12 points at 42,315. The S&P's off 5. The Nasdaq is down 30. This is NPR News.
Hi, this is Casey Grove, host of Alaska News Nightly. You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage FM 91.1.
Attention Chugach Electric Association members. One director will be elected to the Chugach Electric Board in the upcoming 2025 election. Chugach members interested in helping shape Alaska's energy future are encouraged to apply. Chugach Electric Association is also accepting proposals for bylaw changes. This is an opportunity to help refine the rules that guide the cooperative. Applications for the Board of Directors and bylaw changes are due by 5 p.m. Monday, January 27, 2025. Visit ChugachElectric.com or call 907-762-4489 for forms, bylaws, and more information. This message sponsored by Chugach Electric Association.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Alejandro Mayorkas just spent 4 years running a vast part of the U.S. government. The Department of Homeland Security includes everything from the Secret Service to the Coast Guard, everything from border enforcement to cybersecurity. Congress assembled this agency after 9/11, and ever since, it has faced the question we put to Secretary Mayorkas in an exit interview. Does the Department of Homeland Security, as a department, make sense?
Yes. And I think it is more fit for purpose than it ever has been.
Mayorkas visited our studios as he prepares to hand over his portfolio to the Trump administration. We heard his answers yesterday on immigration. Today we talk more broadly about the alphabet soup of agencies he oversees, CBP and ICE, FEMA, even the FLETC, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Centers. He says global and domestic threats demand that those agencies work together.
We are in a heightened threat environment, Steve. Adverse nation states, foreign terrorism, domestic violent extremism that fuel a heightened threat environment.
The events of New Year's Day underline the diversity of threats. Police say a man attacked a crowd in New Orleans, having been inspired by ISIS, a global terror group, yet acting on his own. One question for DHS is how to head off similar threats in the future.
The issue is, how do we, as a society, identify when an individual is descending down a path of violence, increasing isolation, withdrawal from important people in their lives, statements made in person or online through channels that are publicly accessible? How do we identify that and intervene? From a public health perspective, we have efforts underway. We have a Center for Prevention and Partnership, where we are taking a health-informed approach in communities across the country, really locally based, federally supported, and seeing if we can intervene and prevent an individual from actually committing an act of violence before it's too late.
Let me ask about an agency within DHS that had to respond to threats in the last year, the Secret Service. Is the Secret Service understaffed?
It is understaffed. It is under-resourced. The failure of July 13th...
the assassination attempt.
...was a failure of operation, not attributable to a lack of resources. That was a failure of operation. But let me say the following. The Secret Service is under-resourced, it is understaffed, and I continue to believe quite strongly that it remains and is nevertheless the best protective service in the world. And what people do not see is its successes, because success means that there is nothing to see.
Isn't Customs and Border Protection also understaffed?
Yes, it is. And we need more Border Patrol agents. We need more customs officials. And this is not only to serve our nation's physical security, but it also facilitates lawful trade and travel and will serve to fuel America as an economic engine.
The Government Accountability Office had a report recently which found that you had made efforts to recruit more border agents, offering bonuses and so forth, but that you still weren't keeping up with attrition, the number of people who leave. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's been a tough time for law enforcement in this country. I do hope that we turn that corner very rapidly. It is an extraordinarily noble profession. There was footage from the New Orleans tragedy where there are a number of officers captured on video one can see them receiving in their earpieces news of an event that turned out to be indeed tragic, and they all run towards that event. They run towards danger with the sole mission of helping others. That is a remarkably heroic image of heroic people, and I hope recruiting flourishes by reason of that.
Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, thanks for coming by our studios. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
On January 20th, as the Biden administration leaves power, Mayorkas steps down as Secretary of Homeland Security.
People who fled the Los Angeles wildfires had to make choices, what to take with them and what to leave behind.
My name is Gary Hull, Jr. I competed in 3 Olympic Games. I live in Pacific Palisades, California, and operate a swim school teaching little kids how to swim.
My name is Chrissy Carr. I'm a librarian at the Los Angeles Public Library.
It was late morning. I looked out the front window, saw a plume of smoke.
Went to the end of the driveway and I could see the orange glowing down the street.
Another minute and I saw flames, houses going up just up the road. I had one trip out to the car and already embers were raining down on top of me.
So I thought, well, that's close enough.
So I grabbed my dog. I have type 1 diabetes, so need insulin to live. Grabbed that out of the refrigerator and that was all I had time to do.
3 days worth of clothes, my iPad, my phone, and then I left thinking, I'll be back.
I have 10 Olympic medals, 5 gold, 3 silver, 2 bronze, and the thought definitely crossed my mind, do I have time to get them? I did not.
I didn't take my laptop, for Christ's sake. There's a family history book I could have grabbed.
There was no planning. It wasn't like, okay, here's the checklist of things. I didn't take my birth certificate. I didn't have time to get any of those things.
My grandmother's sewing machine, I've been sewing on it for 50 years. It was beautiful. It was black. A sweater I got in Canada. You know, it's just something that you love and it's comfy. I went with someone, so I wasn't alone. And we hiked up through, man. Stuff is still actively burning. There's down power lines, gutted out cars. My place was still smoking.
I am not back to the property. I do know that my neighbor's house burned. Maybe there's something that's salvageable. I don't know if the metals are melted into one chunk or not.
The filing cabinets took it like a trooper, I'm telling you. I pulled out pictures of both sets of my grandparents. And they just like came out of the friggin' ashes. It was so bizarre.
That's Chrissy Carr of Altadena and Gary Hull Jr. of Pacific Palisades. After we spoke, Hull learned his home was gone. The International Olympic Committee said it would give him replicas of his medals. This is NPR News.
Thanks for tuning in to Alaska Public Media. This is Ava White. A Juneau lawmaker is once again pushing to revive a pension system for state and local government workers, including teachers in Alaska. On Friday, Senator Jesse Keel, a Juneau Democrat, pre-filed Senate Bill 27, a proposal to reinstate a pension-style retirement system that was nixed by the Alaska legislature in 2006 in favor of a 401k-like program.
This is an important thing that we got wrong 20 years ago, and we need to get right. It's very clear that this doesn't just benefit employees, it also benefits the state. And it also benefits cities and local taxpayers.
Keel says that the lawmaker's decision nearly 2 decades ago backfired. That's because the state and local agencies and school districts are struggling to recruit and retain enough employees. Keel's bill is similar to one introduced last session by Senator Kathy Geisel, an Anchorage Republican. Her bill passed the Senate but failed to advance in the House. Geisel filed a pension bill again this session. Both bills will start from scratch because a new legislature is convening. Keel says he's optimistic that restoring state pensions will get the governor's support. Just last session, Governor Mike Dunleavy said he was skeptical that a pension plan would actually move the needle in recruiting and retaining staff. Lawmakers from around the state are already arriving in Juneau. The first session of the 34th Alaska Legislature is set to begin next Tuesday. January 21st. You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage.
Americans have a loneliness epidemic, so says the Surgeon General. Screens and social media are the problem, right? Well, a few apps claim to be a solution to connect people in real life. Friend Making, next time here and now.
This morning at 9.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, May Martinez. Turns out Philadelphia Eagles wideout A.J. Brown's playbooks include a bestseller. During the fourth quarter of their playoff win over the Packers, Brown was sitting on the bench reading the self-help book Inner Excellence by Jim Murphy. The book has since skyrocketed to number one on Amazon. Brown says he just likes to read, and he highlights passages to bring him a sense of peace. It probably helped that the Eagles had the lead late in that game. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from ECMC Foundation, whose North Star is to eliminate equity gaps in post-secondary completion by 2040 so that underserved learners have greater opportunity for social and economic mobility. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. The mayor of Anchorage has thrown her support behind the Aklutna tribe's efforts to build a small casino on the outskirts of the city. Her endorsement comes as the Bureau of Indian Affairs has closed public comment on the project. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, it's a small piece of property that raises some big issues.
The land in question is just off the Glen Highway's Birchwood exit, only about 6.5 acres on a native allotment that could become another important test case for tribal sovereignty in Alaska. Governor Mike Dunleavy has already targeted the project in the wish list he sent to President-elect Donald Trump. He asked him to reverse an Interior Department decision last year that gave the Aklutna tribe the okay to pursue its gaming hall. In contrast, Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance has given her wholehearted support. She says the project will generate hundreds of jobs in the construction phase and even more after it opens.
We believe that there would be a spillover effect, too, that would boost surrounding businesses, hotels, and workers.
In mid-December, the BIA opened up its environmental assessment of the project for comment. LaFrance said in her written response, the assessment found no significant concerns. We'd like to formally share our support for the native village of Aklutna as it exercises its sovereignty and pursues economic development, words that LaFrance says reflect her confidence in the tribe and its track record for environmental stewardship.
There is such an emphasis on listening, problem solving, and being very open about the situation. And so I feel like that's part of what makes the relationship so strong.
It's really good to see Mayor LaFrance embracing what the tribes have to offer.
Longtime tribal advocates like attorney Sky Starkey say the mayor's public comments on the environmental assessment are unprecedented.
They're remarkable from the standpoint that they're from Alaska. They're not remarkable if they were in many, many other states that have good working relationships with tribes.
Starkey says while other states have long recognized how tribes bring jobs and economic development to the table, Alaska's state government has been bogged down in a debate over the legitimacy of tribes.
It's a constant struggle to advance the ball, hopefully through good relationships like the mayor's and others, Alaska moves forward.
Michelle Demert agrees. She's assistant professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where she works in the Tribal Governance Department.
Tribes are really great partners. We bring in a lot of money. We bring in a lot of resources. We want the same types of healthy communities for our villages like everyone else wants.
But a group of neighboring property owners say the mayor shouldn't have endorsed the project without hearing from them first. In a lawsuit, they argue the land does not have Indian country status that would permit a casino, which would also hurt the rural character of their community. Debbie Oseander is not part of that lawsuit, but lives about a mile from the site. Her biggest complaint is that the BIA only allowed 3 weeks for public comment on the assessment and its supporting data, which includes hundreds of pages of highly technical information. Plans call for a restaurant and space for up to 700 electronic gambling machines. The tribe says it'll use the profits for scholarships, housing, healthcare, and cultural programs. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
This is Alaska Public Media.
Thanks for tuning in this morning. This is Ava White. It's 7:49 on Tuesday, January 14th. Right now at the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport, it's 30 degrees with clear skies, 26 degrees up on the hillside, also 26 degrees in Wasilla, and in Girdwood, it's 20 degrees and partly cloudy. Back in the Anchorage area today, expect mostly sunny skies with calm winds and a high near 28 degrees. Tonight, there's a chance of snow with lows dropping to the low 20s. In the Anchorage area today, we're gaining over 4 minutes of daylight. The sun will rise at 9:57 and set this afternoon at 4:20. Roads were slick on my way in, but right now looking at 511, it doesn't look like there's any traffic backups in the greater Anchorage area, but drive safely wherever you're headed. The time is 7:50. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday morning. You're listening to Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1. Catch Alaska Public Media in your feed to share great stories and important news with your friends. Follow us on Instagram at Alaska Public.
Right now, Alaska has thousands of youth that need a home where they can feel safe, supported, and loved. As a therapeutic foster parent, you'll work with a dedicated team to provide care and guidance for youth in need, help them stay closer to their communities, and get the support they need to thrive. To learn more about how you can become a therapeutic foster parent and help youth in your community, visit fostercarealaska.org. This message sponsored by Denali Family Services and AK Child and Family.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Let's recall the basics of Senate confirmation hearings. The president nominates people for senior posts who get the job with the Senate's advice and consent. The notion is that in a republic, which we have, no one person ever gets all the power. So the Senate acts like a board of directors with power to ratify or refuse the CEO's hiring choices. It is rare for the board of directors to flat out reject a nominee, but it's also normal for a president to make uncontroversial appointments with some view to who he can easily confirm. In 2025, President-elect Trump has challenged lawmakers with less conventional appointments like Pete Hegseth, whose hearing for defense secretary comes today, or Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the nominee for Department of Health and Human Services, whose hearing is not yet scheduled and who faces questions on issues from abortion to vaccines. Here's NPR's Sarah McCammon.
A little more than a year ago, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was a Democrat running for president. Since then, he's dropped his party affiliation and backed Donald Trump. Trump's selection of Kennedy to serve as Health and Human Services Secretary is drawing pushback from members of both parties. Here's Hawaii Governor Josh Green, a Democrat.
He's dangerous as a healthcare leader. He's not a healthcare leader. He's got no training.
Green, who's a physician, was part of a medical mission to the Pacific Island nation of Samoa in response to a deadly measles outbreak in 2019. He says Kennedy bears significant responsibility for spreading misinformation and fear about vaccines during Kennedy's own visit to Samoa earlier that year.
And 83 people died in Samoa. We watched it firsthand, and that will happen in America if he becomes the director.
The Trump presidential transition team hasn't responded to requests for comment on the controversy or Kennedy's nomination. Kennedy denies spreading misinformation, though his criticism of vaccines is well known. That's why some Republicans are also raising concerns. Here's Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana.
I'm old enough to remember when children couldn't go to school for quite some time because of measles.
That's Cassidy speaking with News Nation in November. As chairman of the Senate's Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, Cassidy is expected to play a key role in Kennedy's confirmation process. Cassidy is also a doctor. He said he agrees with Kennedy on some goals, like reducing ultra-processed food in American diets, but he told News Nation he disagrees with his views on vaccines.
And the older doctors told me that they, when the measles vaccine came out, they just closed whole hospital wards because no longer were people going blind or going deaf because of mumps or measles.
Kennedy has described himself as an advocate for medical freedom and bodily autonomy. His application of those views to the issue of abortion has also raised concerns from some conservatives. On the Sage Steele show last May, before he dropped out of the presidential race, Kennedy said he viewed every abortion as a tragedy, but that those decisions should be left to women.
No, I wouldn't leave it to the states.
Wouldn't, right.
No, I would.
He would say completely... It's up
you
to
know,
the woman.
My belief is we should leave it to the woman. We shouldn't have government involved.
Even if it's full term?
Even if it's full term.
Okay.
That's at odds with Trump's position that the issue should be decided in the states. But after recent meetings on Capitol Hill, several Republican senators have said Kennedy assured them he would support Trump's position if he's confirmed as HHS secretary. I spoke with North Carolina's Ted Budd after he met with Kennedy last month. Budd said he asked the nominee about his position on abortion.
He has been moderate on that in the past, and now he's going to align himself by choice with President Trump on pro-life policies.
But that's not convincing for some anti-abortion activists like Brent Leatherwood, president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention.
You'll have to forgive me for remaining a tad skeptical.
With conservatives in control of all major branches of government, Leatherwood wants the second Trump administration to go farther than it did last time. For example, using regulations to limit access to abortion pills.
But to do that, you have to know the administrative state and be willing to tackle it. And I think you can only do that successfully on this issue if you have a deep commitment to the sanctity of life. And he just hasn't shown that.
If he's confirmed, Kennedy will lead a critical federal agency responsible not only for medications and vaccines, but also for programs that provide public health insurance to millions of Americans and for overseeing the nation's response to emergencies like pandemics. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
Okay, Senor Martinez.
Yes.
Are you one of those people who's, you know, cut the cord?
Yeah,
gotten rid of cable TV?
Just about. There's only a couple of local news stations in L.A. That's the only reason I even have it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I don't have cable TV anymore. I do watch cable, CNN and some others, but I get it through a streaming service. A lot of Americans have cut the cord, and so have many in the U.K. And now, for the first time ever, a streaming service, Netflix, overtook BBC One.
Dun, dun, dun.
In British TV ratings. Jake Cantor is the investigations editor for Deadline, which reports on the TV and film industry, and they investigated this, discovering that Netflix temporarily dethroned BBC One for a few months last fall.
And then in December, BBC One overtook Netflix again. And that's not entirely surprising because December is a big month of viewing here in the UK. We have real established and decades-long tradition around Christmas Day television viewing.
I won't even try a British accent. But Netflix could, I mean, could rise again, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. That's possible. That's possible. And the BBC told Deadline it's meaningless to compare everything that Netflix streams to a single little TV channel.
And that the entire BBC portfolio, so that includes all of its television channels and its own streaming service called iPlayer, the BBC is actually much bigger in audience terms than Netflix.
It's still, though, amazing that an American company might challenge the BBC for its own viewers.
Yeah. Cantor says Netflix has somebody in the UK specifically in charge of original programming there.
We've seen big British shows performing extremely well, both here in the UK and internationally. I would point you to Baby Reindeer, which obviously has made waves on both sides of the Atlantic.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is my stalker. Say hello to Mark.
Don't you say that to me! Apologize to me right now!
I just watched the show Keira Knightley on Netflix.
So oh,
I
think it's really?
Classic.
woman, sweeter she be. Blacker the woman, sweeter she be. Just take it from Houdini, all black women sweet like a honeybee. Blacker the woman, sweeter she be. Blacker the woman, sweeter she be. Just take it from Houdini, all black women sweet like a honeybee.